Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
We can't see numbers. We can't taste numbers. How do we know anything about them?
One possibility is that numbers are ideas in the mind.
Are numbers God's ideas for making the universe?
Most of them, the vast majority of them, no one has ever bothered to think about. Can there be ideas that no one's ever bothered to have?
Now if a six turned out to be nine,
our guest is Gideon Rosen from Princeton University.
I'm with Plato. I think the only defensible way to think about numbers is to think of them as invisible objects.
What is number? Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local, innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the beautiful Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air. And from the air, we migrate to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And you know, you can now listen to Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime by downloading one of our podcasts.
Well, Ken, today we're talking about what numbers are. Now, this may not be a topic our listeners just wake up in the morning worrying about.
What is two? What is three? I bet you're right.
I think I am. So we ought to explain that ontology, that is the investigation of what various kinds of objects are, particularly objects you can't see or smell or touch, is a big part of philosophy and has been since Plato.
What do you mean you can't? You're right about that. What do you mean you can't see or smell or touch? I just touched one pen. What can I touch? Didn't I touch one?
You can touch one pen, but can you touch the number one? I mean, the number one, where is it? Is it like owned by some American corporation? No, I don't think so.
There you go. You're right about that. It's an abstract object, right? And it doesn't exist in space-time. It's like somewhere else. But I'm going to tell you, numbers are really intrinsically puzzling, aren't they? I mean, there are lots of numbers. How many? Think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the natural numbers, right?
I can do that. I can count 1, 2, 3. Yeah, I got that far in math.
No, just take the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, right?
So I take half the numbers, the even ones, and leave the other half the odd numbers.
When you take half of something, you usually have less than you started with, right?
That's right.
But you know what? There are just as many even numbers as there are total numbers, because you can count the even numbers. 1, 2, 3, the first even number, the second one, the third one, the fourth one. You can keep going on and on and on.
Ken, you got to be nuts. If you take half of something away, you've only got half.
Look, suppose you take the even numbers and the odd numbers, and you got half the numbers over here and half the numbers over there,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, they're both got the same amount. But if you put them together, you end up with the same amount you started with.
So I guess the idea is you take any even number and you compare it with a regular number, because you can say, take half of it. And so you'll never run out of even numbers to pair with the regular. That is, numbers are kind of amazing.
That's because there's so many of them. There's an infinite number. But there's something even weirder, right? These infinities, they get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. There's like a small infinity, then a large infinity, then a larger and larger and larger. So it's really weird. Like there are more real numbers than there are natural numbers.
I thought our discussion was whether there are any real numbers.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. Do you think mathematicians worry about this?
Well, I suspect they don't worry about it as much as philosophers would like them to. But I think our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, files this report about that very subject.
There are some things we don't question, but maybe we should. Take the meaning of numbers, for example, and the importance we give to them. We can't feel or taste numbers, but does that mean they're not real? Philosophers may question the existence of numbers as anything more than ideas, but try saying that to a mathematician.
I think for most mathematicians, these philosophical questions about where numbers exist and how they exist is just not of major concern. It has no effect whatsoever.
Here's Robert Osserman.
This is the way I tend to think about it. I do think of numbers, as I think of most mathematical concepts, as residing in some sort of if you want to say ideal space, somewhere separate from the physical world. All attempts to really understand the world around us has forced us to look at numerical ways of viewing things, quantitative. If we want to really understand the function of, the way a tree grows, and fractals have been used to describe coastlines and clouds and circulation systems. If you were living on some other planet, around some other star, and looking at the planetary system on your star, you would, if you studied it long enough, presumably notice they travel in ellipses, just the way Kepler did, and you'd be forced to come up with a notion of an ellipse.
If numbers are so exact, what about pi, an approximate number? Maybe numbers are less precise than mathematicians would like to admit.
The fact is that the degree of accuracy that one obtains with numbers is something like unbelievable. I just went yesterday to see this IMAX movie, The Mars Rover, and they emphasized the astonishing feat of shooting a rocket off at a certain time, at a certain place, and a certain velocity in the Earth, and hitting this speck, a tiny crater on Mars, you know, at this incredible distance, and that one is able to calculate all the different factors and plot a trajectory and achieve this. So numbers are incredibly effective in many, many different things. The big issue is the noun three, whether that exists or in what sense that exists, where you take three books and three stones and 3 days and three whatever and abstract the threeness and come up with a new concept, which is the number three. And I guess the big debate is, where does that number three reside?
Whether or not numbers exist in space and time, we all use mathematics devised by Fermat.
Every time you enter in your, speaking of numbers, your Visa card number on a computer, it's safeguarded mostly by something called the RSA system or a similar one, which uses just these obscure properties of prime numbers that were studied 300 and more years ago by Fermat and others, and suddenly have an application in the real world. It's not like physics, but it's very important to most people.
Maybe the next time my credit card bill comes due, I'll just try telling them that the numbers on it don't exist. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, and thanks to Robert Osserman, one of my favorite mathematicians, of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Gideon Rosen, who's a professor of philosophy from Princeton University, a guy we've tried hard to lure to Stanford with no success. He's co-author of a fine book, A Subject with No Object. Gideon, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, Ken. Hello, John.
Hi, Gideon. Thanks for joining us. Now, I've got a kind of a long question to which you can no doubt give a brief answer.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now, most school children think that numbers are just numerals, the signs they make when they do arithmetic and balance or checkbooks. And their teachers say, no, you got to distinguish between numerals and numbers because the numbers are there when you're not writing them down. Plato, at the other extreme, thought that numbers were non-physical, non-sensible things in a sort of a special heaven, more real than anything we encounter in our lives. Now, there must be some other, dare I say, more sensible positions in between. Get us started in thinking about this, will you?
All right. Well, in fact, I'm with Plato. That is, I think the only, in the end, defensible way to think about numbers is to think of them as invisible objects, of which there are infinitely many. Now, that raises all kinds of philosophical problems, and you're right. As soon as you hear somebody say it that baldly, you want to know what the alternatives are. One possibility that you sometimes hear is that numbers are ideas in the mind. Numbers are somehow things that we make or construct when we think. And, well, that seems to bring them a little bit closer down to earth, and you can see why somebody would say that. It's a view, though, that raises all kinds of puzzles.
Wait a minute, Gideon.
Yeah?
I'm sure there's puzzles for that view, but let's start with this Platonism that you just endorsed.
All right.
Numbers are invisible objects. They're not just invisible. They're inaudible. You can't touch them. You know, you can't have any kind of causal contact with them. So here's my question. If the Platonism is right, how could you possibly know? We think we know all kinds of things about numbers. But if they're invisible, insensible objects with which we never have any causal commerce, how could we possibly know anything about them? I mean, how could we do that? It sounds magical.
It does sound magic. And someone who defends the Platonist view that numbers are invisible, mind-independent objects either launches into some odd supernatural parapsychological story about how nonetheless we can have something like perception of them or causal contact with them, or he says what I'm going to say, which is that the way you learn about numbers is by doing mathematics. Somehow or other, when you were taught elementary arithmetic, you were taught a way of arriving at new beliefs about numbers, calculation, and then when things get more advanced, proving theorems. I say, that's a way of coming to know about numbers, and anyone who says otherwise is a skeptic.
Okay, but now you snuck into this description, mind-independent, right?
So
you think numbers are mind-independent, invisible, intangible, unsensible objects, and you were going to start telling us what was wrong with a person who has what sounds like a kind of a common sense view, that they're just ideas in our mind. I guess then they wouldn't be mind independent, but why should they be?
Well, whose mind are they in? Is the number 6 in my mind? Is it in your mind? When I do math, am I studying what's in my head? When you do math, you're studying what's in your head?
That is a problem, isn't it?
Well, we got it. It's in both of our heads. Why is that? It's in everybody's head who can think about numbers. Well, what's wrong with our sharing ideas?
Well, you know, that sounds almost odd as the idea that they're nowhere. Now there are these things which can somehow be in many places at once. That's a little odd. Now, another worry, as you stressed in your opening setup, there are a lot of them. There are, in fact, infinitely many of them. And most of them, the vast majority of them, no one has ever bothered to think about. Can there be ideas that no one's ever bothered to have? Whose head would they be in?
And if I got an infinity of them in my head, why don't I have an even worse headache than I do?
Exactly.
I suppose they could be in God's head. That must be what, say, St. Augustine thought.
Right. So there's a long tradition in the history of thought about mathematics which recognizes that numbers aren't ordinary, tangible, physical things, thinks they therefore must be mental things of some kind, realizes that they can't be in our finite, imperfect minds, and concludes that they must be in the mind of God. Now, that doesn't solve the epistemological problem. That is the problem about how we know about these things at all, because it's puzzling how we can know about objective, mind-independent, invisible things. It's also puzzling how we can know about the contents of the mind of God.
But I think we've got a false dilemma here so far. Either they're objective, mind-independent things, or they're in the mind of God or some other minds or something. What if we just said, and I'm about to say, there just aren't any numbers? Just like there isn't a Sherlock Holmes, there aren't any numbers. Now, there are all kinds of fictional worlds, you know, in which and all kinds of games we play with terms like Sherlock Holmes, but the numerals don't stand for anything, right? There are all kinds of games we play, and we use numerals and measuring things and all that stuff.
So
kind of numerical discourse, number discourse, but no objects. What's wrong with that view?
So, Ken, are you saying that when math professors like Robert Osserman do what they call discovering facts about numbers, they're really just kind of making up a story?
No, I wouldn't say they're making it up. Well, they're continuing a story. They're continuing a story that has a certain structure. Because I can't just say anything at all about Sherlock Holmes. They're really kind of constraints on the kind of thing I can do with Sherlock Holmes. But just because they're a constraint and not anything goes doesn't mean there's an object there. So why not say the same about numbers? That gets rid of all the mysteries, doesn't it?
Well, if there are no numbers and you think that means that the things you learned in school, ordinary arithmetical claims like 2 plus 2 is 4 and there are 4 prime numbers less than 10, if you think all of that means those claims are really false, then you're right. Since you say the claims are false, you don't have the problem of explaining how we can know them because you think we can't know them. Nobody can know something that's false. This view, which is perfectly respectable, it's sometimes called fictionalism about mathematics, is one that I have some sympathy for, even though I am mostly a Platonist. Maybe Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm a fictionalist.
I'm going to press you on that in a little bit, okay? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is What is Number? Our guest is Gideon Rosen from Princeton University.
We've been talking about the various theories that philosophers have put forward about the nature of numbers. We'll continue that and ask why one should choose one position rather than another. What kind of arguments are there in this subject we call ontology? We'll look at this after the break. If you've got any knockdown arguments about numbers or other abstract objects, jot them down now.
You can join us by calling these numbers, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Our number is real, fictional, mental. Tell us what you think when Philosophy Talk continues.
Of all the Bushes, that was my favorite, Kate Bush and her song, Pie. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing What is Number with Gideon Rosen. Do you work with numbers? How do you think about them? Do you think of them as real, mind-independent objects that are sources of eternal truths? Or are they out there? Are they in the physical world? Tell us your thoughts.
The number is 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134. Also, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. You can do that from your mailer, or you can go to our webpage, philosophytalk.org, and hit the comments button. Make sure you hit the comments button and not one of the other pretty buttons on there.
Yeah, if you hit the ideas button, we won't get that on the air today. Our guest is Gideon Rosen from Princeton University. Gideon, I want to ask, there's another view that one might have, and then I want to ask you about the fictionalism again. You might think, well, numbers really are in the physical world in the following way. You think, look, physical quantities are real. They're really there. And number talk is really just a way of talking about physical quantities and their relationships. And when we just do mathematics, we kind of abstract away from, right, truths about the physical magnitudes. So the physical magnitudes are real and the numbers are abstractions away from that. What do you think about that kind of view?
Well, first of all, it may be that physical magnitudes are real. It's a little odd to think of magnitudes like, what, being 75 degrees Fahrenheit as existing somewhere in the physical world. They are properties of things like bits of the atmosphere or physical objects that do exist in the physical world. But whether the quantities themselves exist in the physical world is a hard question. It's a little bit like the question whether numbers exist in the physical world.
Yeah, it seems like the properties that we measure can be measured in various systems, and then we end up assigning different numbers to them. So somehow we're not abstracting the numbers from the quantities. We're using the numbers to describe the quantities. But then where do we get the numbers to do that with?
Right. And there are all kinds of other questions about that sort of view. Again, there's the problem about whether there are enough of these things in the physical world to do the work or to correspond to numbers. You know, there are a lot of physical properties or physical quantities. Are there a vast infinity of them, enough of them to stand in for the real numbers, for example?
But if I were to think this way, which I don't, but I would respond to what you just said, I think, by saying, well, look, you know, when you do this abstraction thing, you kind of unhinge yourself from the constraints given by the physical world. The physical world is finite, let's assume, and there are only finite magnitudes in it. But when we do this abstraction thing, we just reiterate and reiterate and reiterate, and we generate all these magnitudes that have no that answer to nothing in the physical world. So part of mathematics is just purely empty, just an idle wheel spinning. We're talking about these super large cardinal numbers. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I was just talking about large finite numbers. They don't have to be large infinite numbers. What I think about that is this talk about abstraction and extrapolation can be understood in a number of ways. The most natural way for me to understand it is when you get a bunch of things that are similar in various ways, different in other ways, you can talk about what they have in common, their similarity, the property they share. That property that you're talking about isn't something that you invent. It's a real thing that was there anyway and would have been there if you had never gotten around to talking about it. That's one way to think about abstraction. The other way is the fictionalist way. You pretend that there are these objects that correspond in some way to the finite, motley things you've got in the physical world. But that's a version of the view we were talking about before, according to which really there aren't any numbers, but it's useful for various purposes to pretend that there are.
So you said on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I think you said, you're a Platonist, and on Tuesday and Thursday, you're a fictionalist. Tell me what draws you to Platonism, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and what draws you away from it toward fictionalism on Tuesday and Thursday?
Yeah, I just must say that today, Tuesday, 3/14, is National Pie Day, so it's kind of uncharitable to pie to be a fictionalist today.
It is.
Yeah. Tell me why you waffle.
All right, well, the official position, which is a form of Platonism, goes like this. Look, there's the mathematics you learned in school, and before you get to philosophy, nothing is more certain than that. If you know anything at all, you know that 2 and 2 are 4, you know that some numbers are prime. If you've learned a little higher mathematics, you know that there are infinitely many prime numbers. That's one of the first interesting theorems about numbers that anybody ever bothered to prove. These are things you know for certain. Now philosophy comes along, and it starts asking embarrassing questions. Sometimes philosophers recoil too quickly. They think because there are some embarrassing questions about common sense or about established knowledge, they instantly need to back off, reconsider, say we don't really know any such thing, maybe it's not even true at all. I think, in general, that's a recipe for timid philosophy. Philosophers ought to have more courage of their convictions. They ought to be more inclined to defend and to shore up what they really do already know. And one thing you really do already know is all the mathematics you learned at school.
Okay, but wait a minute, Gideon. Yes. We have a caller on the line who wants to challenge Platonism, so I'm gonna subject you to a challenge from Will. Will, right, in North Carolina. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Will.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling all the way from North Carolina. So what's your challenge to Platonism for Gideon Rosen?
Right. So my question is this. In the case of mathematical truths, as you guys have pointed out, philosophers have on occasion concluded that numbers must be actually existent objects, that the number 2 must be an object, for example. But consider moral truths. Wouldn't it be absurd for philosophers reflecting on the nature of moral truth to conclude that evil, for example, must actually exist as an object? When Bush talks about the axis of evil, for example, I doubt anyone actually thinks that he's talking about some object that exists in Iran and North Korea.
So if I say there's evil in North Korea... Right.
Right,
you're saying that you're saying it doesn't follow from that, and it's true in some sense, that there's an object evil that resides somewhere in North Korea.
Well, it certainly seems like it would be strange if that were the case, because for one thing, would we say that same object is in Iran and North Korea and in a whole bunch of different spatiotemporal locations? Or
so you're agreeing that there are things, events that are evil, but you say it's I think sometimes we. In philosophy, we talk about hypostatization. It's a kind of a fallacy to go from that there is one object that would be named evil. And you wonder, isn't that the same thing we're doing when we get all hung up about the number 2?
What do you think, Gideon?
Well, what I think is, you're right. It would be much too quick to move from the fact that we've got some resonant phrases involving a noun, evil, to the conclusion that there really is such a thing as evil. The most natural thing to say is that, well, as John said, there are evil people and evil countries and evil thoughts. Evil, as it figures in that sort of claim, is a property of events or people or thoughts or whatever. And maybe properties are things. If properties are things, or entities, if there are properties, as I suppose there must be, then I would conclude simply from the fact that the word evil has an indispensable use in those contexts, that there are all kinds of true claims you make where evil functions as an adjective. It may follow from that, with some other premises, that there is such a property as the property of being evil. Now, whether there's a thing evil sounds like a slightly different question. It's true we've got the noun as well as the adjective. When should we think that a noun corresponds to a thing? My hunch is that we should make that inference when we have a well-disciplined, worked-out discourse in which the noun figures indispensably. So if you ask me what evil is like, what properties does it have, I don't have much to say.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you ask me what properties the number 6 has, I have quite a lot to say.
But thanks, Will. That's an interesting question. But Gideon, still, I mean, there are many two-numbered things. There are 2 cups in this room. So some things have the property, as it were, of being 2-numbered or 1-numbered or 3-numbered. But again, it's just like the evil thing. Why go from many things have the property of being this or that numbered to there are these numbers, these entities in a Platonic heaven? Because I don't know. It does seem like reifying something that doesn't deserve to be reified.
Why doesn't it deserve to be reified?
Why does it deserve? I should think the natural, the starting point, the default is not to reify. No reification beyond necessity. Or
yeah,
anything
but
like
but
that.
Just to come out on Gideon's side here, maybe with an argument he wouldn't countenance. But I mean, why do we reify things we can see? Well, when we find a lot of properties that are intimately related and seem to project onto further properties, then we think about a thing being there. That's what things are for. They're to glom together properties. And so if numbers are not just things that we use to describe the properties of other things, like there's two cups, but also things that have a whole bunch of properties of their own, why aren't they as good a thing? Isn't it just a prejudice? Because you can't see them, you shouldn't reify them?
Well, maybe. Phil in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phil.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the parallel between the argument about letters and the alphabet and the whole idea of language with respect to numbers, because you could argue that numbers are the language of mathematics and it could be considered a construct.
So what's your question? I'm not quite sure what your question is, Phil.
What the argument, if the argument is parallel between the idea about language and numbers, as you're talking about.
So there's an old tradition that, I mean, Ostermann brought up Kepler, and all those guys thought mathematics was the language of God. And so the idea that mathematics is some kind of special language is a very old one. But are languages really any less mysterious than numbers? What do you think, Gideon?
Well, I think there's a nice point there. There's a view that we haven't had on the table yet. Look, think about the letter A. Where is it? Well, particular instances of it might be on the piece of paper in front of you. But the letter itself, where is that? It's not anywhere. It's abstract. You can't see the letter itself. What you can see are particular marks on paper or scribbles on the blackboard or whatever it is. But so there's a sense in which letters are also abstract objects, but nobody thinks they're eternal. Or anyway, that's a weird view. Obviously, the letter A has a history. For a long time, it didn't exist at all, and then the Phoenicians started using certain signs, and eventually the Romans had this symbol, which they used to express a certain sound. That's a history. These things are abstract, but they're not timeless.
Right.
So another view is, yeah, numbers are abstract objects. They're not literally in the mind, they're not literally in the physical world, but that doesn't mean they're these eternal, timeless, unchanging things, as Plato thought. So you could take that view about numbers.
So, but when we discover imaginary numbers or large cardinals or something like that, when we discover those things, we don't discover them, we kind of invent them? Is that, I mean, what we would say about that question?
Well, yeah, that's the view that I was just describing would say, yes, there are moments of invention in mathematics where new objects are brought into being, and you bring them into being, well, who knows how exactly, but roughly in the same way that you bring new alphabets.
Or a novel, I take it, right? A novel is kind of an abstract object, but it comes into being at a certain time by some acts of some novelist, I take it, right?
Right. So that's another good example. You know, you take Jane Eyre, the novel itself, not your copy, not my copy. Where's the novel itself? Again, the same puzzlement arises, but again, everyone knows that's an object that came into existence at some time in the 19th century. So you could say that numbers are like this. They are abstract artifacts. I just don't know why you'd say it.
Well, Sarah's on the line. Sarah in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sarah.
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
Me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, I'm a third grade teacher, and I teach, you know, multiplication tables and all those great things, and I'm always referring to things as, you know, groups and concrete objects, and I guess I'm still unclear as to what the difference between an abstract number and a concrete number is.
Okay, Sarah, Gideon's going to help you straighten that out. I don't think there are any concrete numbers, are there, Gideon?
No. What you got in the concrete world are lumps and heaps and stacks of blocks and maybe marks on paper and things like that. Those are items which are connected to numbers, but they're not the numbers themselves. Arithmetic isn't literally about anyway, this is how the philosophers would say it. Arithmetic isn't literally about those things. Those are aids for teaching people arithmetic and for helping people think about these things. In principle, though, you could do, this is a big in principle. This is not psychologically natural for human beings. It may even be impossible for human beings. But in principle, you could do mathematics without any of those material aids. They're props that we weak human beings need to get ourselves onto these objects that exist anyway.
So thanks for the call, Sarah. Gideon, I want to press you on the novel analogy, because you said you don't know why you would say something similar about numbers. I agree, but I think there's a deep point here. When I write a novel, right, what do? I first write down some words on a manuscript, and I give it to the publisher, and the publisher publishes it, and he makes multiple copies, right? None of those are identical with a novel, right? Because if I lost my manuscript, the novel would still exist, assuming I got it to the publisher first. If your copy is burned, the novel still exists. But what did I do? I instituted a kind of structure of relationships among possible instances, right? And the talking about the novel is a convenient way of talking about relations among possible instances. So your copy and my copy stand in this relation of being copies of the same novel, right? X and Y have this relationship of being copies of something. And so it's a way of instituting a way of talking about relations among concrete particular things. And maybe that's all number talk is for, of talking about relationships and properties of concrete particular things.
Let me put it in a slightly different way before I let you comment, Gideon. I mean, take a novel. Now, a novel is an abstract object. You can't identify, or take a song. Take Hey Jude, just to keep a little more timely, right? You can't identify Hey Jude with a particular performance of it, or with a particular piece of sheet music, or even with ideas in any particular person's head. But somehow you feel that everything that is true about the song Hey Jude is grounded in facts about minds and pieces of paper and performances. Isn't that a very attractive feature of this analogy between fictional objects and numbers? At least, even if we couldn't identify a number with any particular concrete object, we could see in some sense how the whole discourse is grounded in minds and pieces of paper?
Yeah, I think that is attractive. It's not as if we really do understand how it is that all the truths about Hey Jude are grounded in, you know, what the Beatles did in the studio that day. But it's plausible. It's true. Somehow or other, abstract artifacts like songs and novels are the way they are because things down here are the way they are, because of what we've done, because of how things have gone on in the perceptible physical world. Yeah, that's true.
But go ahead. Sorry. Are you there?
I'm right here. The thing about the mathematical world is, first of all, we haven't written down particular instances of even a tiny fraction of the mathematical objects there are. We have written down mathematical theories. You know, some of them are quite explicit and formal. For a long time, they were just scattered and implicit. And I suppose you could say that there are mathematical objects and that all the truths about them are grounded in ways we can't begin to understand in any detail, our mathematical jottings, our writings, our mathematical thoughts, our mathematical practice. All of that entails, by the way, that there were no numbers before there were intelligent beings, before there were mathematicians.
Oh, we're going to leave that thought hanging. Okay. See what our audience does with it when we come back. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing what is number with Gideon Rosen from Princeton University.
We've talked quite a bit about what numbers could be, and we've seen an analogy. Some think it's good, some think it's not so good, between numbers and other abstract objects. We'll continue with this discussion when we come back.
Yeah, we'll get to more of your calls, your emails, your favorite numbers, your favorite theory about numbers when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Lemonheads with their song My Hero Zero. That's from the TV series Schoolhouse Rocks. I'm sure many of you, like me, remember not watching it in the 1980s.
You're John Perry.
I'm John Perry. That's right. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing What is Number with Gideon Rosen from Princeton University. We've been asking ontological questions about the existence and nature of numbers. What about mathematics? Do mathematicians need to care whether there are numbers, whether they're just fiction? Could we do science without number? Give us a call and tell us what you think.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And you can email us comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Gideon, I want to ask you about this question. I mean, philosophers like you and me and John, we're gripped with ontological questions. I mean, but does it really matter for the purposes of, say, mathematics or science what numbers are? I mean, couldn't science say, well, if numbers turned out to be just fiction, yeah, that's all right with me because I still use them in my theory. If numbers turned out to be platonic entities, that's still all right with me because I still use them in my theory, and it makes no difference to mathematics. What do you think?
I think there's a sense in which that's true. First of all, I think it's clearly true. Mathematicians don't need an answer to the philosophical question, what is a number? They may not even need an answer to the philosophical question, are there numbers? Now, of course, they do think they have an answer, or at least when they don't get spooked by philosophers, they're pretty confident about their answer. It's part of mathematics that there are numbers. It's a theorem in the same sense in which 2 plus 2 is 4 is a theorem. So mathematics involves an answer to that question. But if you imagine a tribe who doesn't have our confident, naive view about mathematics. They engage in it, but they very self-consciously think of it as a game. They say, let's pretend that there are these things, 0, 1, 2, and so on, and they teach people the game the way we teach real mathematics. They could go on and find out, look, this game they've just invented has some very interesting properties. It's like chess, very simple rules. All of a sudden, there are all these problems which don't have obvious solutions, and they could start trying to work out what would be true if the things they were pretending in this game were true. That would look an awful lot like modern mathematics. It would have much of the intellectual interest. It would require the same kind of ingenuity as our mathematics requires. So for the purposes of pure mathematics, I think for the most part, it wouldn't matter much if you took a fictionalist attitude towards mathematics.
We've got an interesting email here from Rick who wants to hear some comment about the Lakoff-Nunez theory, which I'll try to quickly summarize. We're born with an innate ability to count to three or four. We leverage that with language, in particular metaphor, which, as we know, Lakoff is very much into. So higher math and different numeric systems are really complex systems of metaphor that follow exact rules and give predictable results. How does that particular take on this kind of fictionalist theory strike you, Gideon?
I find it odd. Well, here's what I think. If you tell me that some mode of speech is metaphorical, I can ask, what's it a metaphor for? And usually, you can at least begin to say in more literal terms what you were trying to get at by the metaphor. Most of the time when we use a metaphor, especially if it's a clear, fresh metaphor, it's pretty obvious to us on reflection that we are speaking metaphorically and that there's an interesting question, can we say more literally what we had in mind? You can't always nail it. But mathematical language, by contrast, feels completely non-metaphorical. It feels like the very paradigm of literal language. So if someone linguist is going to tell me that it's really metaphorical, I suppose those guys are pros and they may have their reasons. They must have their reasons. But I'd want to see what the evidence for the claim that mature mathematical language is fundamentally metaphorical. It may be that we have to learn it by going through some metaphorical phase or transition.
I think they may have their reasons, but it doesn't follow that they're good reasons. Mike in Berkeley's on the line. He says he's going to prove that there are numbers. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mike. You going to prove that to me?
There was a book written called What is Mathematics, Really? And I thought that was kind of arrogant, so I read the book, and I proved to the author, he said that mathematics was invented by humans. I said, that's impossible. And my example is, take two bananas and you show them to a monkey. And then you turn around, you hide one of them in your shirt. And you turn around again and you give him this banana. He's going to look for the other banana because he can count to two. And that probably works with higher numbers too.
So you think that proves that there are numbers?
There are numbers outside of humans.
Well, thanks for the call, Mike. What do you think about that? Is that a proof that there are numbers, Gideon?
No. It's a proof that there's a certain kind of thought that even the monkey can have.
Right, exactly.
The thought that if there were two bananas a second ago, there are two bananas somewhere right now. That use of the word two is as a quantifier or as an adverb. That's not a use of the word two as a noun. Monkeys don't do that kind of mathematics. So I don't think the availability of that kind of proto-mathematical thought in animals, and I think it goes down, pigeons can do something like this, shows that before human beings, there was the kind of mathematical thought that we're now talking about, mathematical thought that treats numbers as objects.
Well, I think Mike makes a good point. Thanks for the call, Mike, though, that, I mean, whatever numbers they're getting at, even if they're fictional, they're getting at something that you don't have to be a party to human fiction to understand. That I guess that's pretty obvious. I do say it's a risky proof, because if you put a banana under your shirt, the chances of ending up with a squashed banana all over you are pretty high.
Well, I think there is a deep point there, but not about the nature of numbers, but about the nature of various cognitive systems. I mean, we come equipped in the world to find the world numbered, measurable, quantifiable. I mean, we have these representational capacities in our resonant in our brain that enable us to, you know, to count things, to measure things. It takes a lot of stuff in there to do that. But, you know, it could just be, couldn't it? The Kantian in me, the kind of quasi-Kantian in me, could just be, well, right, number talk is about the system of, I won't say it's about this representation, but when we engage in number talk, we're using these representations to cognize the world, but there may not be any sort of objects out there that answer to these representations. I mean, why think that there are objects that answer to these representations that are in our head?
Well, and as author of a book called Subject Without an Object, you must be a little bit sympathetic to that, aren't you, Gideon?
Well, the book is actually a polemic against this view.
Oh.
The book is an argument against the tendency in the philosophy of mathematics to think there are powerful arguments against the view that numbers are objects, so we should fish around for interpretations of mathematics that dispense with mathematical objects. And what the book does is, in part, examine the philosophical motivations for the view that there's something fishy, something exceptionable about the idea that numbers are objects. And, well, it casts a dim light.
But let me ask you, why not this? Well, tell me why not, and shortly. Why can't I believe there are numerical representations in our head that we, with which we cognize the world, and all these constraints on how we deploy them well or don't deploy them well, but we don't need to project from our ability to deploy these numerical representations to there are numbers out there that answer to these things. Why do we have to do that?
Well, I might ask you a related question. So, look, we represent the world as containing other people with other minds, and no doubt at some fairly deep innate level, we are disposed to take the sensory input we get and to produce representations of a world containing other people and other minds and physical objects in space. If I said, so why should we think that there really are other people who think, or physical objects in space, given that we're disposed to take the sensory input and construct representations of these things, you'd think, I haven't given you real doubt for...
No, because I'd say the persons, I meet with them in my experience. I mean, in the inward stream, I have to say, ah, there's a person there. All I meet with in my experience are physical magnitudes.
I don't know if you can hear me,
well,
but
we
I can
hear you.
You.
But
we can hear you.
But he can't hear us.
I'm back.
Okay.
The
good
persons and all these other things, I meet with them in my experience. The numbers, I don't meet with the numbers. I meet with physical magnitudes and all that stuff, but I don't meet with the numbers in my experience. That's where we started. So I have these representations that enable me to cognize physical magnitudes and relations among magnitudes, but they don't enable me to cognize the numbers themselves. That's just a philosopher's fiction.
Well, maybe John in San Anselmo is going to clear this up for us. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So what's your comment?
Well, I think that the philosophy of Carl Jung, the Swiss psychologist, the point is that there is an archetype of number, and the purpose of the archetype of the number is to order the chaos of our lives.
Well, that, I mean, that sounds plausible.
That doesn't clear up Gideon in my debate. So.
No, but it just sounds plausible. So, Gideon, I'll give you a little breather here to respond to Ken. What's your response?
All right. You know, some philosophers inspired by Kant or some views of Kant will say, look, what you meet with in your experience are not literally other people, certainly not the thoughts of these other people. What you meet with are sensory images, and the rest is some kind of construction. I won't go that way, though. Let me not...
Good.
Good. Let me not press you on people. Look, suppose I said, you never meet with electrons. You never meet with photons. You never meet with, let's say, space or space-time itself. And yet, you think, you can have good reasons for believing in these things that aren't a matter of direct awareness. Numbers might be like that. Not exactly like that. But those examples give us a precedent for thinking sometimes we have useful representations that don't correspond to anything we can meet with directly in experience, and moreover, we have reason for believing that there are real things corresponding to those representations.
Yeah, but in the case of all of those things, what we do meet with in experience are what we take, according to our theory, to be effects of those things. They're part of what somebody, Sellars, I guess, called the causal realm. But numbers don't have causes and effects, do they? So how could they ever really impinge on our evidence?
Oh, they can't. That's right. That is a disanalogy. You need a certain kind of reason to believe in things like electrons, and the traces those things leave in the physical, in the observable world, give you that reason. I don't think you need that kind of reason to believe in mathematical objects. Let's back up for a second. If you start with the Platonist view, the immediate challenge is, as you put it at the very beginning, how do we know about these things? And if you think that there are only a small number of certified ways of knowing about things, sense perception, or the kind of inference from observable traces to unobserved causes that goes on in natural science, then you really will wonder how you could ever know anything about numbers. I say you started with too slim a diet of examples of bona fide knowledge. Mathematics is another perfectly good way of knowing about things, and what it puts you in touch with, that bad metaphor, what it supplies you with knowledge of are precisely numbers.
Mark in San Francisco is on the line. You'll be our last caller. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I just had to call in. The whole time I've been listening to your program, I've been driving around delivering dry cleaning, looking for addresses. And every single time I'm looking for a number, and without these numbers, I would be totally lost. So I don't know what to say about that, except, boy, you know, they sure seem real.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Well, they certainly look, it would be hard to do mathematics, it would be hard to do science without number talk. I don't know if that shows the reality of numbers.
Not to mention hard to deliver dry cleaning.
So, Gideon, on that note, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. It's been really great having you. This has been a great discussion. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest has been Gideon Rosen, professor of philosophy at Princeton University, co-author of a very fine book, A Subject with No Object.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, or a lot of them today, and the emails we didn't get a chance to read all of those either, but we do appreciate them, we do read them, we think about them, so thanks a lot.
Yeah, I see the lines are actually still buzzing. You can leave comments with our screener there, and maybe we'll respond to them. So, John, what did you learn today? What are you thinking?
Well, it was fun talking to, you know, one of the really bright young philosophers out there. I mean, young, at least from my point
of view.
Well,
he's getting a little older. He used to be a really young guy, now he's getting a little bit older.
Just sort of a young guy,
yeah.
But anyway, he's a really smart guy, and he has... It was really good to hear a robust defense of Platonism, or what we call Platonism. I don't think Gideon worships numbers or
yeah.
thinks they're more real in the sensible world, but I like talking to him a lot. And I learned that, you know, I think philosophy can take just about any subject and, at least to my mind, make it turn out really fascinating.
Yeah, you know, you're certainly right about that. But, you know, I'm not convinced of the truth of Platonism. I'm not at all convinced of the truth of Platonism. Even Gideon's argument that, you know, we know stuff via mathematics, and your worry that how could we know it? Do we know anything about a mind-independent reality through mathematics? I don't think that's obvious. There's the form of knowledge, as it were, but why is there really knowledge there? I don't think that's obvious.
Whenever philosophers in a field like philosophy, mathematics, or ethics defend the existence of something you might have thought was dubious, it's got two parts to it: the arguments in favor, and also kind of decreasing your confidence that your reasons for thinking physical objects exist are really as clear-cut as you think. And we were just starting to get into that second aspect of
right.
what I take as Gideon's program. We'll have to follow that up someday.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to have him back on the show. I mean, he was a really fine guest. But, you know, this conversation has to come to an end for now, for this segment, for this show. But it continues on our blog, Philosophy Talk, the blog, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog, the blog.philosophytalk.org.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley. and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW, local public radio, San Francisco, where our program originated.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.